Make Me Smart is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, everybody. I am Kai Rizdahl.
And I am Molly Wood. And welcome to Make Me Smart, the podcast where we wish you were hosting today, because none of us is as smart as all of us.
Let me just say, she is referencing things that happened before we actually turned on the microphones. I'm just saying. All right.
But it's still funny.
It was still pretty
still funny.
And we'll put it in the year-end blooper reel. How about that? I talked to Raj Chetty this week. He is a professor of economics at Stanford. He's got a big project going on the equality of opportunity, or really the lack thereof, and how that is reflected in this economy. We had a good chat.
Yeah, and it is so relevant to all the things we've been talking about, and you have probably seen it rocketing around the internet because it really is a blockbuster study. We are also, later in the show, going to answer a question from a listener about taxes and the national debt, because we can't get enough of that fun stuff. We have even more name suggestions for the kind of capitalism we've been talking about on the show lately. At some point, I think we're probably going to have to make a poll, like a doodle, some sort of quiz, so that we can vote on the actual name to start using in 2018, because we have to put our political party together in our platform.
Wait, are we running? Did we say that?
Yeah.
Oh, all right.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, anyway.
No, I just am announcing it now. We're announcing our candidacy for 2020.
All right. Here we go. Let's get going.
What is free market capitalism?
Is it working for enough people?
No society can be flourishing and happy, of which the far greater part of the members are poor and miserable.
Well, there is hope, but it takes effort.
How do you make people care?
So if you go back and listen to some of the earlier stuff we've done, our guests have given us a good idea on what exists out there now capitalism-wise. Free enterprise and the degree to which that should be more or honestly less regulated. Take your pick.
Yeah, and we have obviously talked at length about what happens when an economy benefits the rich at the expense of everyone else. Take that fun story all the way back to ancient Rome and beyond. And the fact that when an economy gets too unbalanced, you can get populist revolts of sort of varying degrees of severity and or violence.
And that gets us to this suggestion from Alan Greenblatt. They are technically two suggestions.
First of all, I wanted to let you know how much I just love the show. You guys crack me up. I think you should rename it Make Me Smart by Making Me Laugh. What I want to talk about was the choice of words for moral capitalism, which I think we all agree it doesn't quite work and it has a lot of baggage. Anyways, what I think you should call it is balanced capitalism. Because the problem is capitalism gets out of balance, and what we need is more balance amongst who benefits from it. So simply balanced capitalism.
It's not bad. It's not bad. I like that.
Dude, that's so good.
Yeah.
I like that, actually. It has no baggage, you know? There's no kind of politics attached to it. It's just
And it is, you know, fact-based, right? Because capitalism is out of balance right now.
Yeah, totally. I love that. It's like mindful meditation capitalism, except balanced is better. We have also gotten other names, populist or popular capitalism, responsible capitalism, individual optimization capitalism.
Wow. All right, we're not using that one. I don't know who that came from. But
we're not going to use that. Although I could see that in a white paper, the idea, I guess, is that the goal of our economy should be to maximize the output of every individual who is a part of the economy. That comes from Matthew Hoge. I feel like there's, or Hoge, that has unintended consequences written all over it, the individual part.
Yeah. As in, I got mine, the hell with you, right?
Yeah. And isn't that already what we have?
Right.
I'm jumping ahead a little bit to the Madeleine L'Engle wrinkle in time collectivism conversation. But I'll table that for now. Inclusive capitalism was another suggestion, and I feel like that's a good one to end on, because today's interview is about exactly that, using data to track the economic effects of a society where, empirically speaking, only some people get the chance to be inventors.
Empirically speaking is the key word there. I talked to Raj Chetty today. In fact, it's Tuesday. I talked to him today. His project, as I said, is called Equality of Opportunity. He's at Stanford University. Big write-up in the New York Times a couple of 3 days ago over the weekend. But the basic gist is we are missing out on innovations in this economy. We're missing out on progress because the people who would do those kinds of innovations, who would create things like, I don't know, penicillin or a transistor translated to, you know, the modern day economy, never get the chance because of where they are, who they are, or how much their moms and dads make. It's a two-part interview. Talk to him for Marketplace this afternoon on Tuesday. You can get that on the radio or actually on the podcast. But that was kind of the nuts and bolts, and this is the more dig-into-it kind of interview. And here's where it is. This is going to sound like a basic question, but I need to start with you helping me understand why innovation matters in an economy.
Well, innovation is really the source of economic growth, the discovery of new technologies, discovery of new drugs, things that make our lives better, things that ultimately allow us to be much more productive, for example, computers or the internet or the Industrial Revolution. All of that is at the heart of why human beings today in the U.S. and most other developed countries live much better lives, much richer lives, much longer lives than they did in the past.
And what we have here in this paper, most recently from you and your colleagues, is, in essence, the absence of innovation because of inequality, right?
That's exactly right. The paper is about what we call lost Einsteins, a large set of people who we think could have become highly impactful innovators, people who could have discovered the next iPhone, the next blockbuster drug. But because they didn't have the right opportunities, the right background, because they were kids from minority families or low-income families or women, they ended up not coming through the innovation pipeline, and as a result, we have less innovation than we could.
What surprised you most about your results in this research?
I think I was particularly surprised by how specific these innovation exposure patterns are, that, you know, if you grow up around someone inventing an amplifier, you're likely to do exactly that, but not something very closely related. You know, seeing the precision of these impacts was, you know, I would have thought the mechanism would be something more general, like you start to get interested in science, mm-hmm. and that leads you to pursue a career in science. But it's actually, you know, much more like I see a person doing a specific thing, and then I'm more likely to do exactly that thing, which is a very different way to think about how all this works. It's not just about improving schools or doing things at a broader level. It's about giving people role models and showing them pathways in a very direct way, not usually the way we think about it.
It's funny because if you think about what this study kind of implies, as obviously you have more than I, it's really about what we don't have in this economy because of the realities you describe.
I think that's right. I mean, the other way I look at it is often when we think about how to increase economic growth and improve welfare, there's a lot of talk of trickle-down economics, mm-hmm. right, that we're going to give people incentives at the top, and that's maybe going to create benefits for everyone. I almost think of this as the opposite, like trickle-up economics in a sense, right? And that makes any sense. It's that you want to harness this vast underutilized pool of talent that we're not tapping into as effectively as we could. I think an analogy, sort of imagine you're drafting a baseball team. And for some random reason, you decide to leave out 75% of the people you could draft for your team. That would obviously be crazy. You're going to end up with a less good baseball team than you otherwise would. In a sense, that's what we're doing in the current American economy. We're playing with 1/4 of the players we really could, is our sense.
Can I ask you a methodology question here? How do you know? What data did you look at to make these correlations that then let you come out with this analysis?
Yeah, so this is part of, you know, a broader trend in social science, which is the use of big data, much as you hear about Amazon and Google using large data sets to offer better products to their consumers. We analogously in our research group are using big data to tackle questions like this, important social and economic policy questions. And so in this particular case, we use de-identified data from a database linking patent records for the universe of all patent holders in the U.S. to information from tax records. And so that allows us to track the lives of 1.2 million inventors in America from birth to adulthood and basically ask, where did these inventors come from? What do their lives look like? What can we learn from their lives about how we can increase innovation more broadly?
As you sat down to frame this project, you and your colleagues, you decided to go with inventions as a marker for innovation. You used tax records because, you know, that lets you figure out a bunch of other stuff. Did you consider other data sets and other sort of indicators or markers of progress in this field, you know?
So actually, one of the things we're doing at the moment is taking a different measure of contribution to economic growth, which is to look at entrepreneurs. Mm. Who are the people in America who start successful businesses that end up hiring lots of employees? Who are sort of the job creators of America, which is another aspect of growth that's important, right? Even if you don't have a patent, but you start a business that employs a lot of people, you're also contributing to the economy in a big way. So that's another dimension that one can look at, data that we're trying to put together at the moment. A lot of the research we focus on in our group, which we've talked about actually in the past in the show, Kai, is this work on equality of opportunity.
Yeah.
And giving kids from all different backgrounds an equal shot of sort of reaching the American dream. And so we've studied those issues. Like many people, we've been interested in those issues from the perspective of sort of fairness and justice, that the idea that everyone should have a shot of rising up no matter their background. But what struck me here is, even setting aside those concerns about fairness, if you just want to increase economic growth, you might still have an interest in increasing opportunity, because by, as illustrated by the study, by giving kids from lower income backgrounds better chances of succeeding, that could enable them not just to rise up themselves, but discover something great, start an important new business that ends up benefiting everyone. So I think it's a different lens for why we should care about improving economic opportunity beyond the traditional notions of fairness.
Yeah, so there are two ways to look at this, right? One is pure profit making, as it were, and the other one is just being a good place to live.
Exactly.
Yeah. Let me ask you one more thing. It's a little sideways, but it's something we ask everybody when we got him on, and it goes like this. Total change of subject here, by the way, so just bear with me. What is something you thought you knew, but you later found out you were wrong about?
Let me give you an example from my own personal experience. You know, I thought I knew that America was really a great land of opportunity. That's the reason my parents came to this country, and that, you know, it's a place where anyone could rise up no matter the background. I think I've been surprised to see from the work we've done in our group over the past couple of years that at least now is no longer the case in many parts of the country. And I think I've been surprised to find that there are huge differences across different parts of America in kids' chances of rising up. So the idea that America is really the land of opportunity, it's something that I thought I knew. I think it's something a lot of people think they know. The reality is much, much more complicated than that.
So here's what I think about Raj Chetty.
And
this, not so much him, but really this project. I wonder sometimes if people who do this kind of work, and if you just factor in everything that's going on in this country at the moment, writ large, mm-hmm. I wonder if they kind of feel like they're spitting into the wind, right? Because now we know this stuff. We know that we have these issues, and they are not simple fixes, but we have thoughts that might fix it, and yet we're never going to get there because there's so much else going on.
Right.
Oh, look, it's Nothing Matters, Kai. Great.
My favorite, Nothing Matters, Kai. My heart hurts. No, yeah. It sort of reminds me. Well, it sort of reminds me of that poor man that we talked to in Houston, who was sitting in the middle of the flood, talking about how, you know. I mean, they probably feel like Cassandra.
Sam Brody, yeah.
Sam Brody, who was just sitting there, brokenhearted, going, "Yeah, no, I mean, we all knew."
Right. Gonna happen. I'm laughing, but it's terrible.
And we know it's going to happen again. And the water's at my ankles. At this moment, I mean, there could not be a more sort of salient.
Right.
I don't know. It's not even a metaphor. I mean, the man was sitting in the reality of his own metaphor come true. I don't know. I found this study and the Times write up to just be absolutely devastating. Mm-hmm. You know, the research paper talks about lost Einsteins. You hear Raj say, you know, it's essentially like putting together a baseball team where you exclude 75% of the players.
Right.
Like, it's just a blockbuster. It reminded me, I actually made everybody take this quiz before the show. It reminds me, there was a PBS project that was the, what's it called? Like the American Dream Quiz. Yeah. And it was all over, what's your American Dream score? We'll put the link on our website, but it was sort of all over Facebook. And it was about poverty and opportunity in America, and it just assigned people a score. And so many of my friends took it, and the results were just astonishing. Like, you think, like he said, you think that America is this land of opportunity, right, and that if you're, you know, if you're not starving and you're not living on the street, that you're sort of generally doing fine, and you don't even realize that there's this preponderance of, like, invisible factors that are holding you back. And it's so relevant to everything we've been talking about in society right now, the great reckoning around sexual harassment, the idea that there are so many women who never made it into the room at all. I mean, I was sort of struck by the fact that I never even made it into the interview with Raj because I am a single mom who had to get my kid to school.
Right.
You know, which is not, I'm not whining about it, but it's just like, there are certain realities that you can't over. I fly into a rage every time I get invited to a networking conference that would probably be really great for me that starts at 7:30 in the morning and ends with drinks that get over at 9.
Right.
I mean, you're a parent, you know, you're not going to, like, you have a daily show. Like, there's just this set. Yeah. It's like, wait, why is it all? Anyway, I'm trying not to get myself into nothing matters mode. Maybe it matters that we're tracking this now, but that it was a tough read.
So do this, actually. Go to David Leonhardt's piece in the New York Times this weekend and check it out. See the map, and there's links to the study. It's fascinating stuff, if somewhat depressing. And once you've had a look at it, or once you've seen the study itself, let us know what you think. Write to us, makemesmart@marketplace.org, or the website is makemesmart.org. Tweet at us if you like. I'm at Kai Rizdahl. Are you on the Twitter this week, Molly? You know, I think it's not an unfair question.
No, I know, because it's true. Right. I have a limited. Yes, yes. My emotional barometer is allowing for Twitter this week.
At Molly Wood.
We will be at Molly Wood. You know, this stuff is it's all in the numbers. It's all in the data. Yep. I can deal with data, even if it sucks. Okay, we'll be back in a second.
And it's Nothing Matters, Molly. Boom, we're there. I got her. That's how you hijack a show, ladies and gentlemen,
Molly.
Right there.
I know. God, he sent me right down into a spiral. Speaking of a sucking death spiral, we'll be back in a second with a listener question about the national debt.
That was a good segue.
All right, one of our New Year's resolutions is to find the happy place and also to answer more. That music was perfect. All right, we're going to be okay, you guys. One of our resolutions is to answer more of your questions, which means we are kicking off 2018 with Explain-a-thon the third.
Numero trois.
And even though we do have, you know, a 1,000 question backlog, that's not fair. We have made a dent in at least 20 of those questions. The 1,000.
Jenny says we have 1,000. Like, no joke, 1,000.
We have 1,000, but I think we've answered like 20. I bet we have 980. But that said, we want more. We just want them to be... Keep them current. Keep them coming. So send us your questions. makemesmart@marketplace.org. They're always so good. They're so good.
So you know what's an interesting point, actually, just to sidetrack briefly. We want to keep them current. One of the challenges in doing news nowadays is that the news changes so fast, and thus questions become out of date. So if we don't answer yours, it's because, holy cow, things change, and we're trying to keep them
current.
That's
true. The entire economic landscape of the country may have flipped overnight.
Question, here comes.
Make me smart.
Make me smart.
Hey, make me smart.
So make me smart. Where does the national debt and deficit fit into the debate about tax cuts and tax reform? We are currently at $19 trillion in debt, which is about 104% of GDP. When do we need to worry and do something about it? 200% of GDP? 300%?
So... That was, first of all, Chris Miller asking the question. It's about $20 trillion in debt right now, about 106% of GDP. And here's the way I'm going to answer that question. And I'm going to do it in less than 67 seconds.
I was like, time is coming. I know that a time is coming.
Right, okay,
I
ready?
Feel it.
Go. Here it comes.
Yes, go.
So here's the thing. Debt right now is not a huge problem because, number one, interest rates are low. Number two, the economy is growing. Okay? That is the deal. The catch, however, is that $20 trillion is a whole boatload of American money. And eventually, we are going to want to pay it back or at least try to pay it back. And it is in the paying it back where it becomes problematical because when you are paying down debt, you're paying interest and principal, you are not spending money on other things. The other things that we will not be able to spend money on are, oh, just for a couple of instances, education for our children and grandchildren, infrastructure for the bridges and roads and airports that our children and grandchildren will use. And of course, it becomes an even greater problem when you realize you have to borrow more money to finance that debt as it piles up. So the answer is we should worry about it now. We should take action now, but it's not a problem right now, if that makes any sense. That was 62 seconds.
Nice. It's kind of like, in personal finance terms, if you open one of those 0% credit cards and you transfer your balance to it, you don't exactly have to stress about it, but you do still have debt.
Right.
And exactly. That's not great.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Can I do a quick addendum?
Yeah, and then I have a follow-up question.
Because so here's why it's in the conversation now, right? It's in the conversation now because of the tax bill and the $1.5 trillion that it's going to add to the national debt. That $1.5 trillion itself is not a huge problem. We have to acknowledge it and deal with it. But it's the aggregate debt, not the deficit, which is annual shortfalls, but the debt, which is aggregate, which is what matters. Okay, sorry, go ahead.
To whom is the debt owed?
Us. It's a very long story. So part of it is money taken out of the Social Security lockbox. Part of it is Treasury bills and Treasury notes that we as citizens have bought for whatever reasons. Part of it is debt that banks have bought. A very large part of it is American debt that overseas governments, sovereign wealth funds have bought. The Chinese, of course, are a huge customer of our debt, which is why our economies are so intertwined. The Japanese, of course. So it's owed. I mean, American debt is the safest debt in the world for now. And it's a good investment. You will get paid back, full faith and credit and all that. So lots of people buy it.
Okay. That raised like 10 to 100 other questions, but I feel like we could save those for the explain-a-thon.
Explain-a-thon number three.
Explain-a-fun.
Oh, man. Which as it happens, is on, I know, January 3rd episode. So get them in before December the 21st, the questions you may have for Explain a Fun. You can also send us, by the way, comments about A Wrinkle in Time, which is our book club book. And also, we're collecting predictions about what you think might happen in 2018. If you happen to have an area of expertise, gear your prediction toward that. Just to re-up this, you may not say it will get stupider or worse. That doesn't count.
I got to say, I have been so impressed at the extent to which people are not saying that. And we have gotten great, just even in Twitter, like wonderful, you know, somebody said the U.S. IPO market, John Diggles, this is just an example of the kind of thing you could say. John Diggles on Twitter said the U.S. IPO market will roar back after a slow year and there will be potential for energy and entrepreneurs to emerge with breakthrough solutions to get power back on across Puerto Rico and make their name and their tech hot in the sector as a result.
Wow.
Right?
All right.
That is specific.
That is very specific.
Interesting. Anyway, I love that. So that's the kind of stuff we're looking for because that is just outstanding and it will make our show so much better when we're just like, I don't really know because nothing matters. This week in our Facebook Live, which is our new news fix, basically, we got into a great conversation about how Facebook has launched a messenger app just for kids, age 6 and up, which you, you know, here's what we said about that.
The kids these days don't say Google it. They're not doing that whole free branding thing. They say search it up.
No, really?
Yeah. We're going to cover the Messenger for Kids thing in our own way in a couple of days. But what I think is really interesting about it is the universal, it's sort of like how tone deaf do you have to be at Facebook right now to think, hey, you know how everybody's super mad at us about democracy, we should totally try to get some 6-year-olds on the platform. Like,
okay, so look, you're making my point. You remember a couple of months, it seems like a couple of months ago, it was probably only like 2 weeks ago when the Facebook lawyer and the Twitter lawyer and all them were on the Hill. And I said to you, do they just not get it? And you were like, well, I don't know. I think they don't freaking get it. God, you know, you ever have those experiences where you're listening to yourself played back in audio and you think to yourself, God, what a moron. He sounds like an idiot. And Twitter and all of them and the lawyers and the God, what the hell?
It's just extemporaneous into Facebook. Come on. Oh, it's real. It's the real Kai. That's what people come for. Actually, it's funny because every time we play one of these clips now from the Facebook Live, I'm like, okay, I need to be doing these with the real microphone.
The whole audio quality thing. Yeah, I noticed that.
The whole audio quality thing is terrible. Yeah. We do have an interesting plug for the Marketplace Tech podcast. We have an interesting interview about that with a woman who studies the effect of social media on children.
Okay.
And it is... In shocking news, Facebook Messenger for Kids has turned out to be somewhat controversial.
God, can't imagine why.
I know. I have this coming Monday off because I am moving, so look forward to a whole new set for the Facebook Live video the next time I'm back. But I have heard a rumor that Kai's going to do a video anyway, which I really appreciate. It seems like an excellent policy for us to adopt.
Well, let me just say, I'll ramble for about 2 minutes, and then all y'all got to hit me up with some comments and questions, because otherwise it's going to be a super short Facebook Live. I'm just saying.
Help him out,
it'll
peeps.
It'll be on both of our Facebook pages. If you can't find it there somehow, it's facebook.com/KaiRuzdahl. Come on by, because I'll be lonely.
And we have more from you next to continue making our show sound smarter than it actually is. But first, we got to pay the bills.
With the launch of ChatGPT, Sam Altman and OpenAI reinvigorated our imaginations and fears of a world with artificial intelligence. While the company looked like a stunning success from the outside, a battle was brewing within on what the future of AI should be. Almost a year after launching ChatGPT, that battle erupted into a war when the company fired its charismatic CEO, Sam Altman. From Wondery, Business Wars is a podcast about the biggest corporate rivalries of all time. And in the newest season, host David Brown digs into the philosophical differences within OpenAI that culminated in Sam Altman's shocking firing, the chaos that followed, and what it means for the future and safety of AI in the modern world. Follow Business Wars on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus. And for more deep dive and daily business content, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts, with shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, The Best One Yet, Business Movers, and many more. Wondery means business.
Get one of the most successful broadcasts in television history on your schedule with the 60 Minutes podcast. Hard-hitting investigative reports, news, and culture maker interviews, and in-depth profiles are waiting for you in every episode. Listen to 60 Minutes every Sunday wherever you get your podcasts.
Make Me Smart and Marketplace are built, as you know, on independent, nonprofit news.
That is right. We believe that it is our responsibility to bring reliable, objective reporting to as many people as we can, to support informed decision-making, rare as it can be, and thoughtful conversations. And we're asking you to help us do it.
Here's the deal, and it's easy. For as little as $5 a month, become a Marketplace investor.
Isn't that a clever name?
I know.
And the payoff is that when you hear us on the air or online or wherever you listen, it's knowing that you're making it possible for us to reach more people in more ways with more content.
All right, so Molly just said what the payoff was. Here's the real payoff. You are helping us produce journalism you can trust, and that makes us all smarter. Now is the time to do that, gang. Donate today at marketplace.org, and thanks. So today in Kai Does Not Do Math, this correction, we were talking about minimum wage last time after our conversation with Andy Weir, who wrote The Martian and also Artemis. I cannot count the number of people who wrote to us or hit me up on Twitter and said in the kindest possible ways, Kai, you're a moron. Minimum wage in a 40-hour week job does not get you $62,000 a year. It gets you $31,000 a year, which is why I should not do math, and I apologize
Ouch.
For the error. Yeah, I'm a jerk.
$15 minimum wage is $31,000 a year.
And I'm innumerate. Innumerate? Innumerate. I am innumerate, which is funny because I host this show.
But impressively, you kind of just doubled it, so you were—
Well, I was
ballpark.
In the ballpark, right? I mean, literally, I was doing it on the fly. But that being that,
you should
I should just not.
No, you should just tell people that you used the calculator app on your iOS 11 enabled device, which doesn't work, and that it was just a bug.
What is that, like some kind of Apple joke?
Yeah. Oh my God, I'm such a nerd.
What was
Guy,
that?
Oh my haven't God. You heard about the calculator app and how its sums are inaccurate
you know what's
since
really
the iOS 11 update?
We're going to have to leave this in because what happened was you got so irritated with me and yourself that you like blew out the audio. That little crackle right there, that was Molly getting too close to the mic saying, I don't know what I'm doing.
I was trying to do just like a nerd voice. Oh, I was like, goodness. Oh, wow. Yes. Look, it just iOS 11 is buggy. Okay. Millennia Antares. What a great name.
That's a good name.
Millennia Antares writes in on Twitter and said that I, Molly Wood, mentioned that $15 an hour minimum wage could be an alternative to the universal basic income. I disagree, says Millennia. Minimum wage is an outdated tool. It only helps the, quote, desirable poor if they're lucky. And UBI helps everyone, like the homeless and the self-employed.
Sarah Wood writes this, quote, hello, on Kai's supposition that capitalism doesn't care whether you live or die in space, I want to recommend, oh, here it comes to you, Molly, Kim Stanley Robinson's Mars Trilogy, which deals with the mass corporatization of space as Mars is settled. I think Mr. Robinson would be a really interesting person to interview on this topic. Thank you. Sarah, you did talk to Kim Stanley Robinson on tech, didn't you?
I did, Sarah, I agree, and he is fascinating on the topic of economics. In fact, among many other things, I asked him how it would affect our attempt to colonize Mars if the players, which it seems to be this is the trend, were companies instead of governments. Let's just hear a clip.
Oh, I think the dangers are of trivialization, that suddenly the other planets in space, instead of being a commons that all humans are interested in equally as a kind of scientific project of humanity, just turns into another, you know, source of profit and exploitation. It's crazy, and nobody likes it. People loved those first tiny little rovers on Mars because they were public projects and everybody had a stake in it. And if it becomes a rich person's playground or another place to mine, that just diminishes the interest and also the value of it for us. Now, that said, nobody can make a profit in space except for communication satellites in low Earth orbit. Everything that's on Mars, everything that's on the Moon and the asteroids, is exactly the most common stuff that we have here. And so it never pencils out. So I don't worry too much about the supposed corporate takeover of space and of Mars and of the asteroid belt, because there's nothing valuable up there. It's all iron, aluminum, magnesium, dirt, stone, water, stuff we have plenty of already here on Earth, and it's stupendously expensive to go up there, get it, and bring it back down. So, again, this is a kind of a fantasy people have. One has to say that in late capitalism, you have to redistribute, you have to reinvest. Capital is not capital unless it's reinvested and is making a profit. So places sitting on a gigantic surplus, like certain billionaires and China and other places, they need to reinvest. And if there's nothing that they deem worthy on Earth, you can always try the moon or cast that capital up into space and kick the can down the road in terms of having a problem of getting something useful out of it.
Well, that's the thing, right? Excess capital goes looking for investments. And if there's nothing here on the planet that's going to get them the returns, if you got a gazillion dollars, you know, why not?
Yeah.
Oh, look, Jeff Bezos and Blue, what's his name? What's his space company name?
Blue Origin.
Blue Origin. Yeah, you know, I'm just saying.
What I think is so interesting about that is he was sort of saying that private enterprise will go looking, but they won't find anything worth the money and the expense, which I had never heard. I mean, that was totally counterintuitive. There's this, you know, the asteroids that have like $1 trillion worth of materials on them. And and he was like, nah, private enterprise won't do it because there's nothing up there to find. I agree, but
he says there's nothing, but who knows?
Yeah, well, and there may be nothing on Mars, but we do think that, and he said that there was nothing on asteroids, but there's plenty of research that contradicts that, too. I don't know.
I think it's super interesting. I say it's happening.
Yes, I think so, too. But that was also just a nice way to plug the long interview that I did with him, which is at marketplacetech.org. And we'll have a link to in the notes for you, too, because he is super smart, and it was so fascinating. I loved talking to him.
All right, we're going out with a little bit of space. Review us on Apple Podcasts. Tell a friend about the show. Join us for our meetings on Facebook Live on Mondays, noon Pacific. It'll be me solo this week coming up. And also Book Thoughts, which we need by the 11th of December. Producer Jenny is nodding. Make Me Smart is produced by Jenny Josephson and senior producer Nancy Fargali. This week's program was engineered, he's a newbie, Charlton Thorpe. Our theme music is composed by Ben Tolliday and Daniel Ramirez.
The executive producer of Marketplace is Satara Nieves, and the senior vice president and general manager is Deborah Clark.
Okay, there we go. Really, he's singing? I guess.
And dancing.
Are you playing
air guitar? I am singing and dancing.
Air guitar? Yeah.
Here it comes. I threw my arms up in the air.
Of course, the thing is, none of this was guitar. Was this actual guitar, or did they do this all on synthesizer, do we think? I think synthesizer. Maybe guitar. All right, we got to go. Bye.
Bye.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.